ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, Dr. Carl here. Back in 1986, I could not wait to see teacher Krista McAuliffe on the Space Shuttle Challenger launch into space.
Roger, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
We could not believe what we were seeing. The Challenger Legacy. To hear more, search for science fiction and look out for The Challenger Legacy. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Say you wanted to develop an advanced engine for electric cars, Bell. Would you go to a physics professor in Manchester who plays with sellotape and black rocks?
As much as I love geology and stationary supplies, two of my great passions, Robin, I think I'd probably go for someone who works with engines rather than sticky tape and rocks.
Well, they did, and it worked. They made graphene. Welcome to another Science Show with me, Robin Williams.
And me, Belinda Smith.
Yes, we're asking about lateral thinking today. How to discover something stunning by examining a field far away, a subject that seems in no way linked to what you're looking for. And last September, Professor Len Fisher invited 30 top scientific brains to Oxford to test this wild idea.
Len Fisher, Senior Research Fellow at the University of Bristol. I am the chief propagator of our meeting on learning from distant disciplines.
Now, is the distant discipline that of the people involved living far apart from each other, or the ideas being remote from each other?
Oh, it's almost entirely ideas. The point is, if you look at the way that science progresses, we've known for a long time, just as scientists, that most of the major steps come from insights that occurred in totally different disciplines, insights that never seemed to have any application. And people who become aware of those insights, I could use that. So that's a process, and it happens almost entirely by serendipity.
Yeah.
What we're talking about here is whether we can find some better way. I've brought together scientists, the leaders of funding agencies, economists, philosophers, people talking in the background.
We're sitting in a quad of New College, Oxford.
It is absolutely beautiful. It's, what are those things called up the top, crenellations?
Dreaming spires or gargoyles?
Certainly a few gargoyles around. Just take a quick look.
That's right.
Most of them are wearing academic gowns.
Oh, quite. Well, with New College, of course. Angus Taylor was here, you know.
Who's Angus Taylor?
That's the right answer. Forgive Len, he lives in Bristol. But also in the Blue Mountains, half in Australia and half over here in Britain. And let me give you an example of some of the serendipity. There was a case, in fact it was broadcast on Radio National, of the sinking of a ship during wartime or near wartime, and many of the sailors, the crew, were in the water, and some of them got slightly unwell, and they were given a look at by some of the doctors, and they found, much to their surprise, that their white blood cells had increased. And so they thought, well, there must be something in the water that's come from the ship. And they looked down and they found that one of the chlorinated weapons of war had leaked from its tank. And that was the inspiration to some extent for the invention of chemotherapy.
Yeah, so we've got a stack of such examples, but the main stack that I hope will make this work. When I started the idea, I wanted to write to people who'd had the experience at a very high level. So I chose Nobel Prize winners, Crawford Prize winners, that's the prize for non-Nobel subjects, and wrote to a bunch of them, hoping that maybe I'll get one. And if I can use that name, then I can start attracting other people. Well, I got 12, and most of them are here in Oxford. We've got a group of about 30-odd, of whom about half have such a major prize.
And you've got a chief scientist.
Oh, we've got Australia's former chief scientist, Kathy Foley. Yes, she's here. We've got NASA's head of astrobiology. We've got the editor of Nature. we've got a wonderful economist from Cambridge. I've tried to pick as wide a range as possible, but to keep it to about 30 people. And if these people can't come up with some ideas as how to facilitate the awareness of unexpectedly relevant insights, then I don't know who can. But that's the whole idea, is to get them together in groups, to bring them back together, hopefully coming up with some really inspirational ideas that the research councils, the funding people, research organisations like CSIRO can use to better become aware. Especially, I think AI is going to be one of the big tools. We've got one of the founders of Google, DeepMind. We've got Oxford's professor of AI, those sorts of people.
Yeah, to encourage serendipity, to urge it on its way and therefore be more productive. Do we really need far more ideas? Are we somehow static these days?
We certainly need more ideas. All you have to do is to look at the list of major problems that the world is now facing. I mean, not just global warming, but there's a lot of concomitant problems, including displacement of populations, including vast differences in wealth. All of these things are connected. So to solve those, we really need to make big advances in how we understand how the world works. And that's what we're after.
Okay, let's report back when it's over. Thank you, Len Fisher.
Oh, thanks very much, Robin. Great to see you.
Well, that was last September at New College in Oxford, which, of course, is not new at all. It was founded in 1379. See, you have to question everything. And after the week doing just that, Dr. Len Fisher collected all the bright ideas. So what did the aforementioned Dr. Kathy Foley, our former chief scientist in Australia, think of that experience? The plan was to look for science which emerges and something turns up and it looks a bit of a surprise, but it might connect with something else laterally. How do you think that few days went with all those very, very bright people and senior people?
I found it really inspiring because I had missed the opportunity to stop and think about things. I think too often, especially in this modern world we have where we're just on the go all the time, we don't actually sit down and just think about things. And there's some big things to think about. And this gave us a chance to look at how research is done now. And I really enjoyed the opportunity to listen to some, as you said, big brains and be pushed to the discomfort zone, I think, and get that question out there saying, how do we solve our big challenges? How do we actually have disruptive science when there are so many things that are pushing people to do more incremental stuff and safe things and not really be pushing humanity's knowledge of humans as the environment, the world, the universe? So for me, it was great.
Looking at CSIRO, where often these sort of things happen, the main example that strikes me is what happened at a certain division when they were looking for mini black holes. In other words, the idea that black holes weren't simply in the middle of stars and so on, galaxies, but could be just floating around the place. They didn't find them, but in the process, the technology that they dreamed up, someone said that could be good for something called Wi-Fi. So how do you have that inspiration to connect?
Well, I think there's two things there. One is they developed technology to achieve a scientific discovery, which in this case wasn't successful. But it created a capability, the hardware. And the people involved were saying, well, you know, there's this problem of being able to have wireless interaction between a signal and being able to receive it without having wires. So what if we could solve that problem using this technique? Because if we did that, it'd be a real winner. So they knew that they could use it in a different way. And so the guys involved at Radiophysics then just buckled down and said, let's see if we can solve this problem. And if we do, we know there's a market there.
In Oxford, for the meeting that Len Fisher organised with all those marvellous people, there were several Nobel Prize winners. One of them, of course, from the University of Manchester, who'd worked with sellotape to produce something called graphene, a very, very, very thin layer of carbon, which turned out to be very useful in electric cars. Now, there was a nice link.
Well, I think the thing that was really interesting was we had a woman from NASA who's looking at astrobiology and how that can lead us to understanding how we as humans work, because we still don't know an awful lot. We still don't know how the brain works. And yet that's probably one of our crucial challenges as a community, as we're living longer, but our brains aren't. So how can we use that to be able to improve our health? And, you know, other classic ones were Velcro imaging that we have, ones where we were looking at being able to have CRISPR, which was molecular biology meeting with genomics. So there's partnering up of technologies that happen somewhere. And often, if you go back to Schrodinger, I thought that was really interesting in the discussion, saying Schrodinger wrote a book called What is Life? He actually was a physicist who came up with a quantum equation that's able to have the particle wave duality that explained matter so that we could predict its behavior. So really super fundamental physics. And he wrote this book about how does biology and physics interact, and actually was a game changer that led to molecular biology, which of course is a massive area that has impacted humanity in so many ways. And that's the sort of thing which we talked about and heard about, was how do we actually get this happening so that we've got a little bit more control over it? Because at the moment there's a lot of serendipity there, and we can't wait for serendipity. And also the system isn't necessarily allowing that to happen as much as it did in the past.
Is it possible that maybe even science fiction could inspire?
Yeah, I'm a true believer that science fiction is really important. And that's because it creates the imagination of what might be possible. Just getting out there thinking, what if we could have something crazy? And I think Arthur C. Clarke is some of my favourites. And some of his ideas, which were seen as absolutely science fiction, ended up being absolutely critical and something which has led to major breakthroughs. So often I think science fiction really gets our imagination going, because that's where it all starts, is imagination. Einstein said imagination is everything. And when we look at problems, it's imagination that actually breaks through to think in a disruptive and different way to get to a solution we wouldn't otherwise get to.
I wonder whether the formal education in our high schools is up to that, to show young people how to free range intellectually.
There is a bit of a challenge there at the moment. There's a real pedagogy versus content issue. And without wanting to get into an area which I'm not an expert in, I am a trained high school teacher. I've got my diploma in education, but I have not been involved in education in a really detailed way. But I get a feeling that, and this is so happening in so many different areas, you have dichotomies, either black or white, or one side or the other side. And it's never like that. It's always a spectrum. And at the moment, there's a real push towards getting instructional learning so that you actually work your way through. And that is important to understand that, you know, sort of, you know, basic know your timetables, know how to spell, grammar, know how to read, you know, going through and just getting into that progressive way. Yes, that's important. But we shouldn't do it at the exclusion of discovery learning. So how can we actually introduce that? And I know some of the challenges for schools and for teachers, it's just there's so much in the curriculum. How do you actually fit it all in? And this is one of the challenges we have to think about. Can we think about it differently? Can we actually do things differently so we have a different outcome?
Congratulations on your election to be president of the Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering. Are some of these ideas going to be part of your remit?
Well, I am very excited by having this role, because we're at a crucial time in Australia where we need to have really good evidence base for governments to make good decisions. And it needs to be multidisciplinary. And that was one of the things that came through, was having even the life sciences and the physical sciences, but also the social sciences and humanities. We were just talking about science fiction all coming together. And I'm really excited by not just working with the amazing 900 fellows that are part of the Academy, which are some of the smartest applied scientists and engineers in Australia, but also with the other academies, so that we can bring this together in a collective way and have some of these discussions. Different people will have perspectives and views, and I want to get them out. Instead of saying, no, you're wrong and we won't talk to you, we want to say, how are you seeing things and what can we learn from that that might change how we see the approaches to some really tricky problems. I mean, how are we going to get to zero emissions? How are we going to deal with aged caring? The National Science and Research Priorities, which I had the great honour of being involved with, helping the government get those together, they are not easy science questions to answer. I hope I can be part of that vehicle that brings people together to approach things in a way that leads to the outcomes we're looking for. And also realising that nothing happens overnight. We have to be patient and we have to fund things for long periods of time. But, you know, there's some exciting things happening. The strategic examination of the research and development of Australia is coming out in some time soon. I know the government's pondering it at the moment. And that's going to be really interesting because I suspect there'll be some radical changes there. And it'll be interesting to see how we can support the government in making a realistic thing that leads to great outcome.
Going back to Oxford, finally, there was an interesting experience when I became a fellow at Balliol College, which is the oldest college, 1263, and did all sorts of amazing things over history, including helping to invent capitalism. But that's another story. But I asked the master of Balliol, what am I supposed to do? What does a fellow do if you're visiting for a year? And his answer was, we hope that on Wednesday you'll come to the Consilium Dinner. In other words, where all the different people from different faculties sat together, be they classical Latin Greek fellows or scientific ones, you name it, and just talk. And it worked.
I think that is a brilliant design. And that is almost like co-developing the way we think about things. But it's also, hopefully it's got age difference too, because quite often we have early career researchers coming together and the old ones like myself coming together. I'd love to see us actually have that whole, I guess, vertical of ages as well as disciplines coming together, because young people have a different way of looking at things. I can remember my son when he was just a 9-year-old, he's now in his 30s, and mobile phones had just been invented. And he just knew automatically to go through and scroll through things. And I'm looking at my grandchildren who are really, they just need to somehow know how technology works. How is that? And yet us old fuddy-duddies sort of struggle with any of these new things. So they see the world in a different way and we see the world in a different way. So bringing those together and sharing that, I think, is just as important as also sharing all those different things. The importance of the humanities, the importance of literature and music and art is critical for us as humans to really be the best we can be.
Thank you, President.
My pleasure. It's great to talk to you again.
Kathy Foley, former Federal Chief Scientist and now the new President of the Academy of Technical Sciences and Engineering. She was at the Oxford Summit organised by Dr. Len Fisher, and he tells me that they're having a follow-up session later this year connecting distant disciplines. And Bill, soon in the Science Show, will have a report on what matters to young people, where they write, and what's really on their minds about the future.
And I think we'll find it enlightening, Robin. You see, and I'm going to age myself here, I'm an elder millennial, which means I'm well and truly out of touch with, gosh, everything now. But one thing I do know about Gen Z and Gen Alpha is they are certainly not short of opinions and hopes and concerns about what lies ahead.
Thanks, Bill. And this week, you've been doing some marine checking on our mighty whales.
So last year, Robin, you might remember I reported a story for our sister program Lab Notes about humpback whales. A report estimated there are around 50,000 whales migrating up and down Australia's east coast in 2024.
An incredible figure considering humpbacks were almost completely wiped out by whalers last century.
It really is. But it turns out that hunting them to the brink of extinction has left humpbacks today in a bit of a genetic pickle, and one that might affect their survival down the track. That's according to a recent study led by Pierre Pasbel from the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, who actually got his start in whale research in the Arctic because he was handy with a gun, but not in a lethal way.
The first humpback whale I saw, I actually had to take a skin biopsy from. I was in the middle of icebergs in a little inflatable, shooting at this thing with an archaic crossbow to collect a little skin sample. So quite a weird way to get into all of this, but that's how it went.
Yeah, look, it's not your typical whale research origin story, but it was good timing. Pierre started taking skin biopsies from whales around 30 years ago, a time when DNA sequencing was a brand new technology. Now, of course, the cost of sequencing genomes has dropped, and scientists like Pierre can look at the DNA of present-day whales and compare it to those who lived before and during the intensive and large-scale hunting of whales in the 20th century. But before we get into why he did this, a quick recap of whaling. Hunters in the Northern Hemisphere killed whales and dolphins and seals to extract their fat and render oil to use in things like street lamps.
But so that became a major industry that was worth a lot of money. And first in the Northern Hemisphere, it was even back to the 1500s, people would go to Arctic and hunt, well, first right whales and then later bowheads, etc., that were easier to catch. And then as we got better, we went for the humpbacks, the fins and the blues. People did that very efficiently, especially the Yankee whalers in the North Atlantic. But then, of course, we eventually ran out of whales to kill. So then people were looking at the Antarctic or the Southern Ocean.
For most of commercial whaling's history, whaling stations were mainly land-based, snaring whales that swam close to the coast.
And then eventually, of course, all the whale close to shore was killed, but then people developed these factory ships where you could basically flense the whales and render the oil on a big factory ship.
These steam-powered factory ships with their explosive harpoon guns appeared at the start of last century, and they changed the game. Whales were shot, slaughtered, and processed all on the ship while it was out at sea. All whale species were hit hard, not least the humpbacks, which were targeted as they congregated in the Southern Ocean during their summer feeding season. It's hard to say exactly how many humpbacks were killed during whaling's heyday, but estimates suggest around 99% were slaughtered before the global whaling ban came into effect in 1986.
So the Southern Ocean has been hammered quite badly, I would say.
From that point, we've seen some whales make an impressive comeback, but in your new study, you and your colleagues found that genetically, they might be in a bit of trouble. What made you look into their genomes?
So that's one of the things we suddenly can do with genomics that we couldn't do earlier. Still cost a lot of money, but much less than it used to. We can sequence these whole genomes. So back in the 2000s, I suddenly started hitting up people for, well, there must be whale bones lying at these whale stations. Would it be possible to get some subsamples? Because that was the time when ancient DNA, people realized you could extract and sequence DNA in those kind of samples. We started a collaboration with Camilla Speller at University of British Columbia, who's very good at analyzing historical and ancient samples. So she even looks at DNA in samples that are many thousands of years old. So Fabricio, who started a PhD with us at the time, and Camilla was a co-supervisor, as was Eduardo Secchi. He then went to British Columbia with her, extracted the DNA from these historical bone samples that we collected in the 2000s from South Georgia. And then we sent them for sequencing for the whole genomes. And what you can do with whole genomes is that you, of course, can see where there are variation in the population.
And what they found was humpback whales that lived before industrial whaling had much higher genetic diversity, a wider variety of different traits than post-whaling humpbacks. It's like if the humpbacks of the 1800s had a variety of eye colours, from blue to dark brown and everything in between, humpbacks today might only have blue eyes. Pierre and his crew could even pinpoint when this big drop in genetic diversity happened. It was around the time those factory ships really took off.
And that's what really caught us by surprise in this study, because we could see this in the genomes. You could certainly see when you try to estimate the changes in population sizes that in the Southern Ocean genomes, there was this very sharp and drastic decline, which we knew had to be that period.
So why does genetic diversity matter if humpback numbers are bouncing back anyway? Well, if you're a whale in a big pod that has a large variety of different genes, the chances of a calf inheriting the same bad version of a gene from both parents is somewhat low.
But when the population starts getting smaller and smaller, then the frequencies of these bad mutations that typically natural selection is weeding out, and suddenly some of those can increase in higher frequencies, and then there's a greater chance that a calf gets a bad copy, a bad mutation, both from the mom and the dad, also because they all are closely related. It's a small population now, so like a small village having kids now inbreeding.
So if the genetic bottleneck brought on by whaling has essentially concentrated the bad versions of genes, does that mean the same's happened to potentially good variants? Pierre and his team used special software to look into this and found, unfortunately, no, that wasn't the case. In fact, the good versions of genes fell away.
So that means that it's very easy to lose good mutations, and therefore here in this case, then if you lose the good ones, the bad ones are increasing in frequency. It takes a long time for evolution and new mutations to then make new beneficial mutations.
It's easy to lose genetic diversity, just kill a whole bunch of individuals. It's really hard to get back.
Hard to get it back.
While the study did map the genetic changes between the pre- and post-whaling humpbacks, the team didn't really look at the specific effects that these bad gene variants might have on humpbacks alive today.
We mapped them, and this software basically gives them a sort of a high impact, medium impact, low impact, no impact sort of category. But of course, you could go in, localize the genes, and what does that gene do where that mutation sits? But ideally, more genomes to do a better job there.
So what does this low genetic diversity present today mean for the humpbacks that are around now and subsequent generations?
The more genetic diversity you have, it's a little bit like stock portfolios, the more robust you might be against a crash because you're not invested everything in Apple, but also in many other companies. And therefore, while some of them might do bad, others might turn out suddenly to do well. So loss of genetic diversity as such is always of great concern because it means we lose potential genetic variation that might be beneficial for the species in the future, especially now with climate change and so quite dramatic ecosystem-wide changes. The concern is that species need as much genetic diversity to be able to adapt to what's coming, because it might be quite different from what we have now.
Humpback whales and other organisms deal with change all the time. There are natural events, such as ice ages, which can cause their numbers to rise and fall.
But of course, right now, it's A, the fact that humans for quite some time, especially in whales, have exploited or affected natural populations. It could also be just by our presence and removing habitats, not necessarily exploitation directly. And so there's the study we cite in the start of the paper that did like a meta-analysis across 600 and some species and found that there's generally been a loss of genetic diversity, presumably anthropogenic, that's caused by humans. And you were saying earlier that we were very bad with the whales, and it was a very sad story. But it could be similar concerned about a global climate change and warming, but also how we pollute our oceans, how we fish our oceans, how we have cargo ships sailing all over the world, all of which kills not whales and other species, pollution that might slowly but surely decrease reproductive rates, and not in a drastic way that we can easily see, but something that creeps in very slowly.
A warning there from Pierre Pausbel from the University of Groningen. He and his colleagues published their study in the journal Science Advances. And you're listening to The Science Show on ABC Radio National.
Last week in The Science Show about future prospects, we heard briefly from Professor Peter Newman on his new book on green cities. He's convinced that the power of new technologies, such as even revealing whale genomes, as we just heard, is such that countries like Australia do count, despite the political turmoil.
Yeah, and it's happening not just because of the politics, but the politics doesn't go away. Because the reality was that conservative parties stood up for Trump, expecting everybody to say what they did in America. Oh, we've got to give this a try, because that whole nonsense about climate change and so on, oh, geez, we've got to see through that. And they didn't. They did the opposite. They threw out those parties and they said to Labor, get on with it. So we're winning in the politics as well. But in our state here in Western Australia, you'd have to say it hasn't been led by the state government. They have constantly said, well, we're not too sure about all that net zero stuff. We'll do a bit here and there, but we've got to stand up for the mining and resource side of things, which in the end we're going to desperately need for this transition as well, but we do not need the fossil fuel components, and they've been backing them. And I think it will be politically very dangerous because those industries are going to collapse very quickly. They're being destroyed in this new economy. Not because governments are saying that, but because the market is just driving them out. And they just do not have a solution that is cheaper. It is getting more and more expensive, and all of the solar options and even some of the new breakthrough technologies are now commercially better than anything that gas and coal and oil can provide. So that's the big change that you can begin to see in Western Australia as well.
Looking at your book, Net Zero Cities with Sustainability, you've always had a picture of what a city in the future might be like. What's your dream city like now when you think about it?
I think I'm sitting in a bit of it. This net zero complex here at Curtin is very dense. It's been built around the kind of planning and design that has been talked about for a long time in transit-oriented development and the new urbanism concepts that occasionally pop up in other parts of the world. You can see them. They're copying the best of Europe and the best central cities of places like Singapore and New York and London. And these places are becoming more and more walkable, becoming totally dependent on public transport, and the car is becoming less and less a factor.
I saw lots of cars when I came in from the airport, mind you.
We haven't got there yet. We're just starting. And a place like this was designed not around the car. So as you walk down the main street here, it is in fact a pedestrian street, but cars can come down, but come very slowly because it's very narrow. Now, this street was illegal because it doesn't fit with main roads' ideas for what is needed to accommodate the car. But what the local council did was to say, Curtin University can become the council on this. So they had a clearance to do this kind of design. And it worked so well, they're all now saying, well, we want it like that. And it's a bit like the centre of Fremantle, which is a good example of this as well. Well, the rest of Perth is saying that now. We want to be more like that. And even the minister is now saying, we've got to get denser, we've got to get housing in there next to the trains, because we have got some good trains now, 7 new rail lines since I started on it. But we do need to do a lot more redevelopment. And Melbourne and Sydney, over 50% of all urban development now happens around stations and tram lines. That is a big difference. And that's because the market is going there, as well as the local and state governments saying, this is what we want. And that is changing our cities very rapidly. Even Brisbane is going this way now.
Lovely Brisbane, named after a scientist. By the way, you once had an office next to the Premier in this state. Are you going to be part of the advisory action next to the Prime Minister, maybe in Parliament?
No, those days are over. I clearly had my time in the Premier's office. That's now 20 years ago. And I certainly learnt a lot, was able to give 3 years of my time as a professor working on secondment, using all my students and researchers to help with a sustainability strategy and setting up a lot of the projects that are still being delivered. And I did that as a New South Wales commissioner as well for 2 years. And the Great Metro, that was part of the work that I did when I was there. And that's certainly proving to be a great success story, as well as the new light rail system that's there. So those kind of projects do take a while. But the days of being asked to be on those kind of committees and working directly with premiers are definitely over. But you and I still have a role to play in helping shape the world and telling them why the ideas that we've had for a long time actually work, and you can see it happening now. And that's why I write books about this and get on things like The Science Show.
Peter Newman, Professor of Sustainability at Curtin University in Perth. His new book is Net Zero Cities with Sustainability. And so too electric vehicles. Peter says they're very much part of the green revolution he mentioned. This report from Peter Hadfield.
I want to take you back in time, way back, well, 6 years ago, to when Prime Minister Scott Morrison said this.
Electric vehicles currently make up 0.2% of the vehicles market for new vehicles in Australia, and he believes he can take it to 50% in 10 years.
Actually, that was the figure for 2017. Even so, it seemed absurd at the time to think that electric vehicles would ever make a dent in the Australian car market. But that 0.2% has pretty much doubled every year since then. By 2023, electric vehicles were already 12% of the vehicles market, a 60-fold jump in just 4 years. So what happened?
Technology moves so fast, perhaps it was hard for someone like that to perceive something like this at a time like that. You're seeing more and more manufacturers perfecting things like battery chemical technology, the use of systems inside cars.
That was Scott Maynard, Managing Director of Polestar Australia. I met him at the auto show in Sydney, and what better place to find out how far EV technology has come in the last 6 years and overcome some of the problems and misconceptions, like safety concerns, range anxiety, and charging time, which Scott Morrison expressed.
You can go and find those little cars that kids drive around in. They take 8 to 9 hours to charge overnight.
The chemical composition of batteries, yeah, continues to change, and it often brings with it advances in the speed with which we can charge a battery and also the amount of storage we have available.
But it's not just the battery technology that's improved. Polestar's marketing manager, Jonathan Williams, says the software, in this case from Google, has also made charging faster and easier in today's electric car.
You can't underestimate how useful it is for an EV driver in Google Maps. It has things like live feeds of charging stations. It knows if a charging station's occupied or if it's available. It knows if it's a fast charger or a slow charger. It will plan your charging stops for you on a long route, and it will tell you how long it will take to charge your car at that charging station and if it's available.
I'll tell you what, it's not going to tow your trailer, it's not going to tow your boat, get you out to your favourite camping spot with your family.
He was wrong. Electric cars can tow. The remarkable thing about an electric car is that it develops its maximum torque at zero revs, so that's ideal for towing. We're now seeing vehicles with increasing towing capacities, and having that low centre of gravity and a little bit of weight around the car also makes it an ideal towing vehicle.
I'm Scott Dwyer. I'm an associate professor at the University of Technology, Sydney. I do research on sustainable energy and electric vehicles.
We seem to be with electric vehicles where we were with petrol or diesel cars. We'll call them fossil fuel cars in the early 1900s. The technology was very new and it was improving every year in leaps and bounds. Is that where we are with EVs?
We are kind of at that early rapid evolution phase for EVs. Fossil fuel cars are quite mature technology, so they've been around for a long time. The improvements at this stage are much more incremental. With battery electric vehicles, because they're newer, there's a lot more scope for those early innovations. A lot of that innovation is happening under the bodywork of the vehicle. And yes, that can be in the battery. And the other part is the software, but another part is how you actually extract the minerals, how you extract the lithium. Even innovation in terms of how we use the vehicles themselves, we're seeing a number of early adopters in Australia and some government-funded pilots looking at how you can use your electric vehicle to power your home. So most EVs today use lithium-ion batteries, but there are variations. There are new types that are evolving, being developed as well. So sodium-ion is another type, which compared to a lithium-ion battery, sodium is 1,000 times more abundant than lithium. And, you know, salt, it's also cheaper, potentially. So it's another sort of lower cost alternative that companies are looking at, the future thinking, look, could this be a good future technology for the car? Though the thing is that it's less energy dense, so the batteries are typically larger and heavier. But there's a lot of innovation in this field, and you're even seeing some of the largest battery cell manufacturers in the world, in China, building factories that they hope will supply the sodium ion batteries to some car makers. The European car makers, some of the US ones, they're very much focused on solid state batteries. Again, have the potential to have longer range, better energy density, faster charging. But again, that technology at the moment is expensive and can be a bit more fragile. But again, there's companies there that are actively looking at this. Another aspect might be around how we use the batteries and how we optimize them for battery health. So conditioning the batteries. And again, where we're looking at electric vehicles, which you might be using to power your home or the grid. Again, there's potential there for AI to work out, okay, how can we charge and discharge your vehicle's battery to make the maximum cost savings, make the maximum earnings, and maximize lifespan of your battery. How it might work in the future is you have your car at home, it charges either from the grid or preferably from your rooftop solar, which costs you essentially nothing for that electricity. The battery naturally discharges as you drive. And you get home and in the evening peak, the electricity prices start to become a bit expensive and they have to turn on other power generation sources. At this point, your electric vehicle or battery on wheels could then discharge into the grid. You don't have to buy that more expensive power from your electricity retailer. Or if you're discharging it, it could also mean that you're feeding it back to the grid so other people can use that as well. So you can potentially make money from that. And then you, again, charge in the nighttime when electricity prices are a bit cheaper. So ideally, in an ideal world, this is all going to be seamless and won't require you juggling many different apps and doing it manually. And this is where the industry is at the moment. Today, the small number of people that have been using vehicle-to-grid technology, it's been a very manual process, requiring using lots of apps and a bit of knowledge and expertise as well. In the future, we're hoping with some of these early pilots that are being funded for the next 12, 24 months, they're going to be coming up with ways to make it easy and seamless for the consumer.
What you're talking about is a kind of a game changer, because up until now, the big problem with renewables, for example, is the storage. With the old coal-fired power stations, they could just go whenever they needed to provide electricity. If you're depending on wind and solar, you need to store the excess energy that you're getting. But what you're talking about is perhaps the ultimate storage system, that every home becomes part of a huge nationwide storage network of power. Is that what it might look like?
Yeah, that's basically it. So you have 20 million vehicles on the road in Australia. And again, the size of an electric vehicle battery is four, five, six times bigger than a battery you might buy for your home to accompany your rooftop solar system, solar PV system. So where you're thinking that you've got these very large batteries that are parked in your drive, and for the average Australian, you might be doing 15,000 kilometres a year, is parked in your drive for 80% of the time. So that 80%, the battery in your vehicle could be there, helping support the grid, help make the most from your rooftop solar. And while there's still research ongoing, it could actually be that using your vehicle for discharging into your home and grid, it could be done in a way that could be beneficial for your battery as well, compared with driving it on the open road.
Okay, so the home of the future, the husband and the wife go off, maybe in separate cars to their respective workplaces. They park in the street or in a car park. But during the daytime when they are out, how are they going to charge up their cars? What's the infrastructure going to look like?
So that's where public charging infrastructure or charging at your place of work becomes more important. This is why you're seeing companies putting charging stations along highways, in car parks, even in off-site streets off busy thoroughfares, on the curbside. We're seeing these chargers, which kind of look like a giant power bank for your phone, attached to an existing electricity pole. And the idea is you can park beside one of these lampposts with one of these charging units strapped to them, and it'll give you a full charge within, say, 2 to 4 hours. And what we're looking at with the research we're doing in this area today is around how different people experience these types of chargers, what they do when they're waiting. Do they go and spend money? Do they stop for a short charge? What do they do if there's a queue? Do they go somewhere else? What are their preferences? And if it is actually encouraging people to think, oh, there's a charger, I think that gives me a bit more confidence that if I buy an electric vehicle and I can't charge at home, I'm going to be able to charge there in the street. there are some people who still don't really believe in some of the benefits of electric vehicles. There's a lot of misconceptions or misinformation out there as well. So things around EVs catching fire sporadically or being worse for the environment in terms of their lifetime emissions compared to petrol cars, or, you know, you can only charge at home and it takes you a whole day to charge the vehicle to full. So there's a multitude of different challenges here, and I think the Australian case is still quite unique. So industry and government and researchers working together to try and think, okay, how can we make EVs and the benefits of EVs more widely available to the rest of the population?
To sum up, what I'm getting the impression is that the problems are not necessarily technological. The problems are more to do with human emotion and willpower. Is that a good summation of where we are?
Yeah, I mean, that is a huge part of it, and making sure the technology works and is available and the infrastructure's there on time is also a major challenge. But yeah, it's definitely a multidisciplinary challenge here. But I think Australia is well placed to be able to overcome that challenge and also take some of the lessons and benefits and help other countries with the transition to electric vehicles as well.
Back at the EV Auto Show, perhaps Scott Maynard summed it up.
I reckon if we'd always been driving electric cars and I tried to convince you to buy a petrol one, it would be a tough argument. I want you to take the car that you can charge at home, drive silently, have good range.
No pollution.
And I want you to install a tank full of highly explosive fuel in the back of it, pump it to the front of the car, don't ever let it catch fire because it'll really get away from you, and then put a pipe out the back that blurts out really horrible toxic fumes. And the thing we balance to try not to be vibrationary, and you'll have a big complex gearbox inside, you wouldn't do it.
Put like that, you'd wonder why the take-up of electric vehicles hasn't quadrupled every year. The problem seems to be that the technology has improved so much and so quickly that, as Professor Dwyer says, there are still misconceptions about electric cars that haven't caught up. And perhaps politicians and legislation haven't caught up either, because the infrastructure still needs to be rolled out to keep pace. And then there's the economic issue of replacing the excise tax on petrol that paid for the buildings and upkeep of roads, and which could be replaced with a road user charge for electric vehicles. For The Science Show, I'm Peter Hadfield.
Thanks, Peter. Now a reminder that we have among the changes to science programs this year, one regular one, Naked Scientists, on Radio National Fridays at 10 p.m. And a fairly recent item struck me, partly because it features one of my favourite astronomers, Sarah Russell, but also one of those intriguing conundrums we often wonder about. Here's Naked presenter in Cambridge, Chris Smith.
Scientists analysing samples brought back to Earth last year by NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission to the asteroid Bennu have confirmed the presence of DNA and RNA genetic letters, as well as a host of important amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. Planetary scientist Sarah Russell, who's at the Natural History Museum, is one of the team studying these samples. Based on what they're discovering, she strongly suspects that bodies like Bennu, replete with cocktails of important life-linked organic molecules, might well have been delivering those chemicals across the early solar system and are therefore potentially linked to how life first got started here on Earth.
This is a mission called OSIRIS-REx, which is a NASA mission that went to visit an asteroid called Bennu. It launched in 2016. Then it spent a couple of years getting data on the whole asteroid, which is a 500-metre asteroid in near-Earth space. And then at the end of the mission, it collected a piece of the surface of the asteroid and brought it back to Earth. It returned to Earth in September 2023, and we've been looking at this asteroid in our labs ever since.
You've actually got some, haven't you, in the Natural History Museum?
Yes, we do. So I'm a member of the science team, which meant that we got about a teaspoonful of it. And it's like a teaspoon of tiny grains like sugar. We've been analysing it bit by bit.
What is the process by which you look at something like that?
The big aim of the mission is to learn about the origins of our solar system, because we think that asteroids like Bennu formed in the very earliest times in our solar system. And then asteroids like that could have been impacting the Earth throughout its whole history, and so could potentially bring ingredients to the Earth as well. And the way that we look at it in the museum, I'm on the mineralogy team, so we have been looking at it in our electron microscopes and using things like X-ray diffraction to look at what minerals are there and what they they can tell us about how the asteroid first formed from a dusty disk of dust and gas, and then what its history has been since then. So we think that it's accreted with lots of ice, which melted and then formed pods of water inside the asteroid itself.
Would it have been warm enough to have liquid water?
Yeah, so when it accreted, it would have been probably in the outer solar system and very cold, but it contained radioactive isotopes that warmed it up, probably just to room temperature, and so that was enough for the ice to melt and form water.
You can see that. You can see there would have been water in there.
We absolutely can see there would have been water there because we see minerals like salt, like table salt, sodium chloride, which are in the rock, and they formed when the water evaporated away and left it behind. It looks a lot like minerals that we see in evaporative lake deposits on Earth.
As you've gone through this analysis, what are you finding?
We're finding that Bennu was full of water, but it's also full of organic material. And so the organics team have done lots of work, and they've found this whole zoo of organic molecules in there, including all five of the nuclear bases that are used in all biology.
They're the DNA and RNA letters, then?
Yes, exactly. The building blocks of DNA and RNA are inside the meteorite, and so are several amino acids that are essential for life.
Where did they come from?
We think in the very earliest part of the solar system, there would have been simple organic molecules, formaldehyde, methane, just made up of a few atoms. But then in the asteroid itself, maybe in these briny pods of water, these could have reacted with each other to make more and more complex organic molecules. So it would have been just this fantastic environment for producing new organic material.
And the new paper that's just out, what does that add to the picture?
This is a real deep dive into this organic story. And what they found is an additional amino acid, tryptophan. And this is another one of these amino acids that are essential to life. It's quite a complicated amino acid. And we're really excited to see this because this is not something that we've seen in any extraterrestrial materials before. We don't see it in meteorites in our meteorite collection. And the reason for that is probably that it's such a delicate molecule that it just doesn't survive crashing through the Earth's atmosphere and landing on the ground. And so this tells us that it's really important to have space missions like this that can bring back a pristine, uncontaminated sample, bring it back to Earth carefully, and then we can look at it in our labs without it getting contaminated.
Given that things like this would have been raining down on the early Earth probably 4 billion years ago or so, what role might this have played in seeding the planet with some important molecules? Or if they're quite easy to cook up, did we not just have all these molecules here already? Probably. I mean, where do you stand on that?
This is really at the forefront of understanding the origin of life. I think that the results from Bennu really point towards asteroidal material being really important to rain down on the Earth and provide all of these ingredients that would have helped to trigger life to start on the planet's surface, not just of the Earth, but also Mars, maybe also the icy moons around the giant planets as well. So to me, what it's saying is that maybe asteroids particularly are good at being able to make these organic things, but asteroids like Bennu and maybe its cousin comets as well would have been widespread throughout the solar system. And so these things would not have been uncommon raining down on everywhere in the solar system.
It's so exciting, isn't it? That was Sarah Russell at the Natural History Museum.
And that was Chris Smith, who presents Naked Scientists on ABC Radio National on Friday evenings. Next week in The Science Show, young people in Australia and what matters to them, based on 20 years of evidence and a national competition at the University of Western Sydney's Whitlam Institute.
The Science Show can be heard in full on Saturdays at noon and Monday at 4 a.m. Our short version is Monday at 1:30 p.m. and Tuesday, 9:30 p.m., with a full version and individual stories available online and on the ABC Listen app.
I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.